I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to another sidebar episode of Willy Willy Harry Stee, where we look at some of the wider things that were going on during the period. Things that have sort of, where if you're talking just about the monarchs, can sometimes be left out. The lives of ordinary people, the lives of people who weren't nobility. And yeah, just to see what else was going on in the world at the time. And in this episode, I want to look at the fascinating and often overlooked history of black people in Britain, as well as a history of slavery and how that affected British society. I've mentioned slavery in the series and how pretty much from Charles II onwards, it underpins a lot of what's going on, particularly the growth of wealth in Britain and how that fueled the expansion of the British Empire and the Industrial Revolution. And I'm very pleased to be talking about all this with my guest Onyeka Nubia, who is a writer, presenter and historian. He is senior lecturer in history at the University of Nottingham with a particular focus on Africans in ancient and medieval England. And in 2013, he published Blackamoors, Africans in Tudor England, Their Presence, Status and Origins, which looked at the history of black people in Tudor England. He has also written several novels and plays and presented TV shows such as Walking Victorian Britain on Channel 5 and many others, Onyeka.
I think three series of Big Give of Britain and several other things. A 1930s in colour. Being one of the Dam Busters. All kinds of things. A documentary on Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson. Lots of different things.
Well, you've been very, very busy.
There is no rest for the wicked.
Well, thank you so much for finding the time to do this. So can we just start with your book, Blackamoors? First of all, what is a blackamoor?
Oh, very good question. Very good point. So, I mean, the word is itself changeable because the meaning of word change. A word can mean something in 1455 and mean something quite different in 1602, and something quite different in the 18th century and quite different in the 19th or the 20th century. In the 18th and the 19th century, blackamoors are ornamentations primarily. It's a name given to sort of statues of people of African descent with a rich complexion and highly melanated. These are often images which are sort of stereotypical, but fashionista in their approach and rather extravagant. However, if we go back the 400 years to the 1400s and the 1500s, early 1600s, it is a term used to describe people of African descent. Yeah, the term black, obviously a reference to blackness, but not just symbolic blackness, but a reference to skin complexion. And the term Moor, also not a reference to religion until the 18th or the 19th century, but primarily a reference to complexion from the Latin and Greek words moros, meaning black, meaning dark, meaning pigmented. And so it's like saying a black person. In crude terms, So this was the way in which English people, white English people, described Africans. Where did they describe them like this? Well, they described them like this when they were living in their parishes. They described them like this when they were marrying their sisters. They described them like this when they were burying them in their graveyard. They described them like this when they were burying them in their parishes, in Holt, in Worcestershire, in Plymouth, in Devon, in London, in Edinburgh, in Glasgow, in anywhere, you know, where these people were living. Because they were living all over the country, and they were living in Scotland, and they were living in Wales, and they were living in Ireland. So wherever these people lived, were baptized, were married, they were described by in parish record.
So not a derogatory term at the time, simply descriptive.
I say that. However, sometimes they were described by ethnic term. So the term Blackamoor, Moor, and later the term Negro, which was a later term of the later 16th century, were used to describe people of African descent, but not every person of African descent was described by an ethnic term at all. Perhaps because the people that were living in the parishes and living next door to these people and getting married to these people and having relationships with these people saw no need to describe them by ethnic sobriquets.
So how do we know that some of these people are Africans?
Good question, because sometimes they are described by ethnic term and sometimes they are not. There's an example, for example, of Henry Anthony Jetta. Henry Anthony Jetta is living in Holt in Worcestershire, not a metropolitan city, you know, a typical sort of Shire of England village in Worcestershire. And Henry Anthony Jetta gets baptized in Holt in 1597. When he gets baptized, he's described as a Blackamoor belonging to Henry Bromley. Henry Bromley was like Lord of the Estate in Holt. Okay, 5 or 6 years later, he's also described as being the gardener, right? No longer belonging to Henry Bromley, but being the gardener of Henry Bromley. Okay, so 10 years later, he gets married to a woman called Placidia, who I think is actually a white English woman. Because her ethnicity isn't described. It may not be the case, but, you know, that tends to be the rule. Her name is Placidia. They have 5 children, and he has 1 illegitimate child called John Cuthbert, right? These 6 children go on to have 32 grandchildren. The grandchildren, when they are baptized in Holt in Worcestershire, describe their grandfather as Henry Anthony Jetta, the Blackamoor. So the name has kind of become a kind of title by the time that the children are being baptized. Now, Henry Anthony Jetta actually becomes a yeoman. A yeoman was one of the highest ranks amongst commoners. A yeoman could vote in local elections. They could sit as a member in a jury trial. They had to own land and be independently wealthy, even though they were still commoners. This was Henry Anthony Jetta's position by 1626. And Henry Anthony Jetta wrote his own will. Yes, I didn't misspeak, but this African wrote his own will, which anybody can go and have a look at in the whole Worcestershire archive. Please do. And Henry Anthony V's will describes what portions of his estate he is going to devolve to his children. His will also contains a warning to 2 of his children for misbehaving, and he said that unless they behave themselves, their mother, who is the trustee, will give them nothing except, I think, is a small donation of money. So this will written by Henry Anthony Jetta is fantastic. It's fantastic. It's an African living in England in the 17th century who writes his own will, giving his property to his children. Placidia, his wife, when she dies, before she dies, she writes her will, and by the time that she passes, his estates have become very large indeed. And there was a very large list of items that are passed down to the various children, including to John Cuthbert, who is a child born out of wedlock.
So why is all this important?
It's important because there are people living in Holt, Worcestershire, who are directly related to Henry Anthony Jetta. I've met some of these people. And so they have Henry Anthony Jetta on both sides of their family line, but they don't look like me. You people don't look like me. But obviously, Henry Anthony Jetta was sufficiently African enough to be described as a black woman. So this sort of helps to explain that these people in the 15th and the 16th century were significantly visible enough often to be recognized by their ethnicity, but not all the time be recognized by their ethnicity. They appear to have been integrated and assimilated within English society.
There must have been some bigotry around.
Of course, in 15th and 16th century English society, there was evidence of prejudice. There we have, for example, some documents, a letter written in 1596 on the 11th of July, and another letter written on the 18th of July, 1596, and a draft proclamation written in 1601. These documents are often misguidedly described as being evidence of sort of Tudor prejudice. You know, the Elizabeth I's racism, right, the beginning of racism. It's not actually true. First of all, these documents were not written by Elizabeth I. That's the first thing. They were written probably by Caspar van Senden, a Dutch slave trader working from Lübeck in Germany. It's a complicated matter, but it's important. working on behalf or with a Thomas Shirley, who was a nobleman down on his luck, and Thomas Shirley's son, also called Thomas Shirley. So these individuals sort of hatched a base plot to try and gain control of Africans. So these documents talk about Africans living in England, and they talk about them living throughout England, and talk about them being a social problem, and then talks about them as if they are enslaved and as if they can be moved about. And so people often read these documents and say, right, we found it. Evidence of Elizabethan racism. These people were all slaves. They were treated terribly and they were deported. But what they don't do is the further research. What I've found, and some other historians have also found, are a series of about 12 or 13 petitions. These are petitions written by the writers that have written these documents. And in these petitions, they complain that they cannot gain control of a single African. Not one African can they gain control of. And they are unable to gain control of these Africans because these people are firmly assimilated within English society, firmly integrated within English society. And that's why it's not possible to gain control of them, because they are too important to the communities and families that they live amongst. Moreover, Thomas Shirley complains to Robert Cecil that Robert Cecil had lost interest in these activities and will not sanction giving authority for Thomas Shirley to do as he would like. So these documents are not an example of Elizabethan racism. In fact, an example of something else, that England had a significant African presence, and this African presence was part and parcel of the Elizabethan society, and that these people were spread throughout the entire country.
Well, there's so much to talk about there. Firstly, it's very clear that there were a lot more people of African descent living in England than people realise. And secondly, that they seem to have been pretty well integrated and well accepted. So, I mean, would it be right to say that it was the birth of the slave trade and its growth through the Stuart period that changed things? I mean, did that lead to prejudice and racism because it helped to fudge the moral side of slavery, if Africans were seen as lower status than white Europeans?
Not quite.
Right.
So what we have in the 15th and the 16th century is often not institutionalized racism, not the kind of institutional structural racism that we get in the 18th and the 19th century.
Yeah.
There is certainly evidence in the 15th and the 16th century of prejudice. There is certain examples of theological prejudice. You know, the ideas like the curse of Ham, the mark of Cain. These ideas are being discussed about whether, you know, where this complexion comes from. You know, is it a complexion that arises naturally as a result of the sun, or is it because of something inside the humors, the chemicals inside the body? Can the complexion be passed on? What does the complexion say about the character of the person? These are discussions that are taking place. People like Thomas More, yes, that Thomas More, actually discussed the idea of blackness in his book called The First Book. Francis Bacon, yes, that Francis Bacon, actually discussed questions of ethnicity and complexion. Both Thomas More and Francis Bacon fall on the side that this complexion is a natural thing. It's not the result of some theological curse or some abnormality. It is normal. But there is examples of prejudice in English society. People like George Best describes this African presence not very nicely, not very pleasantly. And of course, we must remember, people like John Hawkins and Walter Raleigh and Francis Drake are involved in people smuggling that sometimes involves people of African descent, as well as involving other people too.
So these are all Elizabethan sea captains and sailors, basically engaged in state-sponsored piracy, calling themselves privateers. I mean, are you saying that they're a bit like the modern captains of these boats in the Mediterranean, shipping people for profit?
I mean, I don't think they have a particular prejudice against the people that they smuggle. They smuggle Englishmen to the Spanish and Spanish to the English, if necessary. And certainly they are involved in people smuggling that sometimes involves people of African descent. And John Hawkins, of course, is involved in transatlantic activities, usually as an intermediary between Portuguese and Spanish slave traders. And so we do find some evidence of that. But in England, the African in England wouldn't be subject to the kind of structural racism, the kind of institutional racism, or the automatic inscription that would make them automatically an enslaved person that we get in the 18th and the early 19th century.
And there must have been a history of African noblemen, ambassadors from the Middle East, Indian princes, whatever, appearing at the British royal court. So Africans wouldn't have just been seen as slaves or the descendants of slaves.
100%, Charlie. And thank you for saying that. So this population doesn't suddenly begin in the Elizabethan period. There have been people of African descent here at least since the Roman times. At least since the Roman times. We actually think before, but at least since the Roman times. And there's a continuous stream. In the medieval period, we are just beginning to unpick a very interesting population. You know, they include people like Bartholomew on the run in Nottingham in the 13th century. They include, you know, a plethora of people. There is a group of black Saracens, that's how they're described, living in Biddle, in Staffordshire, in the medieval period. There is the Ipswich man living in Greyfriars Monastery, who was buried there in the graveyard, who was there in the 13th century, who probably came through one of the Crusades. So we find in the church, in particular, a significant number of people of African descent attached to the church in the medieval period. And we find African friends, especially in London, but in other towns too, in the medieval period. So certainly this isn't the first population. So yes, you know, England wasn't a place that's often described, you know, in our thought or perhaps even in our emotional memory, you know, the place where the first people of African Caribbean descent suddenly arrived on the Emperor Windrush in 1948. You know, and this is an untruth.
So slavery had been an accepted practice for thousands of years, pretty much throughout the Western world. The so-called birth of democracy in Greece was based on slavery. The Roman Empire was entirely reliant on slaves. The British, the Saxons, the Irish, the Vikings, most of their raids centered around capturing slaves. But I guess through the influence of Christianity in Europe, by about 1000 AD, slavery had largely died out. The priests were saying this was not a good way to treat other human beings. So what changed in the Tudor period to make people suddenly think, well, you know what? Actually, maybe we can do a bit of slavery. How did that happen?
It didn't. There wasn't a sudden change. And in the Tudor period, people still had this ambivalent, rather reluctant perspective to be involved in these activities. people like John Hawkins and Drake and others that did it to the side. And even though some of the money from their activities flowed into English coffers, there was not a racialized perspective that was governing the enslavement of the people that they enslaved.
Right.
And so these people were involved in enslaving practices and people smuggling with anybody that they could get, Native Americans, okay. Europeans, and African.
And were they entirely being taken over to the Americas? Where were they smuggling the people to?
It was going everywhere, wherever the people could go. We must try and remember that in the 15th and the 16th century, England was forbidden from being involved in trade from a legal perspective, from an international legal perspective. So most Englishmen that were involved in trade were pirates, intermediaries, stealing from people who had already committed piracy themselves. So the English ships would often sneak up behind Spanish and Portuguese ships that themselves were pirates and then steal from these pirates whatever goods or services or whatever they had and then sell that on to whomever would take it on. Yeah. So it wasn't as if English merchants had control of trade, even around the English Channel. What it was is that Englishmen were interlopers, opportunists, and could see that there could be a profit that could be made. The change doesn't occur in the Tudor period, where England becomes an institutionally successful, in inverted commas, slave trading nation. That isn't until middle part of the 17th century, end of the 17th century. Ironically, the monarchs who are most responsible, or the English leaders that are most responsible for helping to support enslavement are people like Charles II, people like Oliver Cromwell, and people like William III. You know, these are people who began to support institution like the Royal Africa Company and others, the Sierra Leone Company, the Guinea Company, to really begin to support these institutions. And these institutions became financially successful. And then, of course, in the 18th century, Britain became the largest slave trading nation in the world. Probably not the largest slave owning population in the world, because Portugal had control of that vast territory that we now call Brazil. But certainly England became, you know, a leading enslaving nation and rivaled France and the Netherlands, Spain and Portugal and the Venetian Republic, who were also all involved in slave trading practices.
So you're saying it's a kind of slow creep that it starts as a sort of underhand thing. Oh, well, let's not talk about that.
Yeah.
And then I guess capitalism gets on board. It's like, well, the Dutch are doing it, the Spanish are doing it, they're making money out of
That's
it.
That's exactly it.
But was that also driven by, did people start trying to justify it by changing the way people thought about Africans?
Absolutely. And you just said it exactly. It requires changing people's views about how they think about Africa. In the 15th and 16th century, there is a kind of ambivalence about ethnography, ethnicity. Mm. This ambivalence and the ideas around it begin to disappear amongst polite society at the end of the 17th century and into the 18th century. Although, of course, in some strands of society, it remained. By the 18th century, we have the birth of the pseudoscience, the science of race. People like Linnaeus and Frederick Blumenbach and these types of writers who are putting human beings into separate racial categories and then establishing a status for each racial category and placing Africans at the bottom of the racial category and saying that they are something of a missing link between human being and animal. These sorts of ideas feed into the economic benefits, if you can call that a necessity, of what the English plantations are now reliant upon. So by the 18th century, English plantations, or should we say British plantations, are now reliant on enslaved labor. And this enslaved labor, in order for it to function, needs to function under racialized law. So there is a development of racialized laws, probably following on from the French. The French in 1690 began the Code Noir, a series of racialized laws that determined that Africans were automatically enslaved, and even those who were dual heritage or mixed parentage were also automatically enslaved. These sorts of laws fed into the development in the English jurisprudence of what they called black laws. They're actually called black laws.
Right.
And these laws institutionalized the inferior treatment of Africans and made enslavement legal, at least in the colony. Because there is a question over where these statutes are judicially applicable. Are they applicable only in the Caribbean? Are they applicable only in the Americas? Are they applicable only in British Guyana? Are they applicable only outside of England? Or do they apply, for example, to the developing African population in Britain at the time? Do they apply to the Africans that are walking around the streets of London and Manchester and wherever and are married to white English people and having children with them? Does it apply to these people, you know?
And I mean, did it apply? Was there status change? Were people being taken off the streets and forced to work?
Absolutely. Some people were being taken off the streets and forced into enslavement and transported to the Caribbean, which is the interesting thing. However, we mustn't think that this was resisted. It was. There were organizations like the Sons of Africa. There are people like Alada Equiano, people like Ottobo Kagana. These are Africans living in England who were connected to white philanthropists and others. And through their connection, they were rescuing people of African descent. Even someone like John Fielding, the brother of Henry Fielding.
The guy who wrote Tom Jones, who I think also set up the Bow Street Runners, a sort of proto-police force.
The John Fielding was in charge of sort of what we might call now police matters. And John Fielding complains in the 18th century that these Africans are so well organized that the people who have taken them, that are to be treated as enslaved, are unable to do so. These black organizations, that he calls them, rescue these people and then get the mob on their side. By the mob, he means the ordinary white population.
Yes, right. The same mob that some of our modern politicians get hot under the collar about.
And he said that the conflation of power of having the mob as well as these black organizations means that it's dangerous for the people that have brought these people of African descent to continue to treat them as enslaved people, right, in England. So the nature of the politics in 18th century British society meant that on the ground in English society, it was very difficult, not impossible, but difficult to keep people in that enslaved position. And Africans would continuously run away from their employer. And there are lots of adverts for runaway Africa. And they run away to the cities. They run away to the towns. You know, they become integrated. It's like very difficult to gain control of them. Having said that, Britain, this is the contradiction, Britain was the largest slave trading nation in the world.
Well,
yeah. We have this strange phenomenon, and we get this in history, where on the one side, Britain is very, very dominant in the 18th century in enslaving people. And then on the other hand, in Britain, it is finding it very, very difficult to keep these people in an enslaved status. And both axioms could work side by side with each other.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we have this system known as the triangular trade, whereby ships leave England laden with cheap goods, which are bartered in West Africa for slaves, for people, who are then taken across the Atlantic, where they're sold to work on the plantations. And the money earned by the slavers is then used to buy cotton, coffee, tobacco, and most importantly, sugar, which is used as cheap fuel for British workers. And so when the ships return to England with this new cargo, as far as the British people are concerned, they've seen ships set off with cheap goods and return with these increasingly valuable goods from the Caribbean. What they never see is the really horrible part of this business, where African people are brutalised, bought and sold. I mean, so did that make it easier for British people to turn a blind eye to what was going on?
This history has tended to be dominated by economic historians who have tended to see it within its economic effects and not its social, political, cultural or its legal factor, and have made sort of assumptions based on that. So we need to sort of unpick this. This wasn't a trade in the formal sense of a trade, because a trade means that there are two or more sides of equal footing and equal standing, passing goods from one to another that each side wants, and both sides reciprocally receive something from the transaction. That's not what's happening, right? African people are the first set of peoples to be involved in the early modern period in the transatlantic activity. Primarily, it is Native American people that that the Europeans who go to North America, Central America, South America, use on their plantations in the Caribbean, in North America, in South America. When the numbers of Native American people decline so sufficiently, there is a call to replace that enslaved labor, first of all, with European. That doesn't work. Then the switch is towards Africa. Initially, they are not sure if it will work. Will the people, for example, survive? Many of the Native Americans and European didn't. The Africans did survive, were able, were resilient enough to survive. So the trade sort of has its economic factor that pushes it. This economic factor, as it becomes an economic factor that is so important to the development of the economy of Britain, France, the Netherlands, et cetera, there becomes a social, political, cultural justification for it. And laws that come in then, and the science that comes in. And then what we have is a kind of social institution. The social institution of enslavement continues even when the economic necessity of it no longer does. So even by the 19th century, many of the economic factors that made enslavement, inverted commas, successful are no longer preeminent.
How come? What has changed?
Mechanization, industrialization. Right. And by the time we get, you know, to the middle part of the 19th century, the second phase of the Industrial Revolution, that makes effectively many of the kind of plantation economies that enslaved labor is often on economically redundant. There's better ways of doing some of the activities that you would get enslaved labor to do. But the social necessity of it means that slavery remains as a social institution, not as an economic one. Okay.
So what's driving that social necessity?
It depends. So if we're talking about the British colonial America, like South Carolina, what have you, the social institution established through the British Empire there becomes something that is a functional aspect of society. So this society is a society in which enslaved labor form a factor, a strata of the society. As time goes on, this becomes a fundamental aspect of how the society functions. And therefore, to disrupt the labor is to disrupt the society. A similar pattern occurs in the British Caribbean, which is why, despite the passing of the 1807 Act, the passing of the 1833 Act, enslavement continues in the British Caribbean, way up until the 1850s, 1860s, on and on. And even when enslaved labor comes to an end, it is replaced by indentured labor. And this indentured labor is in many ways just enslaved labor with a different name.
So, right, people in the Americas are saying, this is how it is. This is the way the world works. We can't change that. And I guess the big difference is that those European colonists out there, they're living every day with the reality of slavery in a way that people in England aren't.
Although people in England, not all, but many of them would have, or at least a significant number of them, would have contact with people of African descent. So even though some of these activities or some of the, you know, the worst aspect of these atrocities may be shielded from English eyes, there are English people who have contact with people of African descent, people who have been enslaved. People like Equiano and Ottobo Kagano, who are living in England, have been enslaved, and they are informing their white audiences about the thoughts and, you know, and sentiments of this wicked and evil traffic, as they say. And these people, in a way, help the people in England understand, even if they didn't understand before, where their sugar comes from, where their rum comes from, you know, where their potatoes come from, where their cotton comes from, you know, where their tea comes from, where their coffee comes from, you know, that they will remind their white polite audiences, you know, that the, and everything that you're consuming, that you are addicted to, comes on the back of enslaved labor. And so when those connections are formed, it means that it becomes, in polite society, amongst a significant proportion of polite society at least, morally questionable to continue to practice it of enslavement. Often it's a moral and theological reason, not necessarily because people have automatically taken on the notion that the African is a human being equal to them, not always, but sometimes because it is morally unjustifiable for Britain to be involved in practices that seem so wicked and nefarious.
So was it a widespread popular movement, anti-slavery? How much was it being driven by people at the top, like Wilberforce, and how much was it a sort of grassroots thing of people saying, no, this just isn't right?
So good question. And it depends when we're talking. We're talking about the beginning of the 18th century. There isn't much in terms of resistance at the beginning of the 18th century from the point of white polite society. What we do get in the 18th century are underground movements in Britain. We get people of African descent involved in activity, rescuing people, etc. We have a sort of a groundswell of people resisting by running away from their employers. So by the middle part of the 18th century and into the sort of 1760s, 1770s, we have organizations like the Sons of Africa. The Sons of Africa are connected to philanthropic and religious and political organizations like the Quakers and other abolitionist society. First of all, people like Granville Sharp, people like Thomas Clarkson, long before William Wilberforce. William Wilberforce was actually a late comer into this. So people like Granville Sharp and Clarkson are interested in ending enslaved, perhaps ending enslavement, or at least ameliorating it, because they're a bit ambiguous about it at first. They're ambiguous about it because the West Indian lobby is extraordinarily powerful, Charlie. It's extraordinarily powerful. And the MPs in Parliament, people like William Gladstone, William Pitt, you know, have their position based on the slave trading economies of their parents, of their family. So the West Indian lobby, you know, the power goes right up to the top. So Granville Sharp and Clarkson in the 18th century are having difficulty trying to get this message across.
So what makes the difference? Is there a tipping point?
It's a slow process. A slow process of talks or conferences or agitation that stirs up, you know, a groundswell. I think actually amongst the ordinary people first, the people that John Fielding calls the mob, the ordinary working class people of the 18th century, who become interested in these activities. And it is Africans who become part of that working class, who then have an effect on polite society. We also ought to be honest and say that the continuous resistance and revolts in the Caribbean and the Americas definitely have an effect on polite society, in particular, the Haitian Revolution and the mythology of the Haitian Revolution. So there is the activities that took place there, which is the overthrow of the enslaved plantation and the replacement of the French polite society with an African sort of establishment. And then there is the civil conflicts and everything else that happened. And then the quagmire that Haitian society then sort of slips and falls within because of the conditionality that the French actually placed on Haiti, which makes it a sort of non-functional republic. But the mythology of the Haitian Revolution is that this is what will happen if we continue enslavement. If we continue enslavement, the next thing that is bound to happen is insurrection, revolution. These Africans, they will overthrow their master. And that frightened many of the societies in the Caribbean. It frightened the USA. It frightened those states in South America where there were plantations. Because on plantations, the enslaved labor often outnumbered their white masters by 10 or 15 to 1.
Yeah. So is there an idea that, you know, rather than let it fall into chaos and we lose everything, let's work out a civilized, organized way of dismantling
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. The legislators in Westminster are really afraid. In the 18th and the 19th century, British Empire was very large. However, as we well know, there was a civil, what we might call a civil conflict, what we often call the American War of Independence. The American War of Independence, the financiers behind that, for the most part, were slave owners and slave traders. You were like Thomas Jefferson and Franklin and these people, George Washington. These are very wealthy landowners who had enslaved labor and who didn't want to pay taxes to the British Empire. The fear is that these sorts of people who existed throughout the British Empire might do the same as their American counterparts. So the fear is that the British landowners in Jamaica and Barbados and Antigua and St. Lucia and St. Kitts and St. Nevis and these places would do the same with the people in British Guyana, that they'd make themselves into a republic, you know, separate themselves from Parliament and say, look, you know, we are now going to use our very rich, very wealthy plantations to finance an independent nation. And worse still, ally ourselves with the French, which is what the Americans did. And then Britain not only loses that, but it loses this whole sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere. So the fear is that that would happen. British colonial officials, to mitigate that, do three or four particular things. First of all, they expand the empire. So the expansion into the Indian subcontinent happens as a direct effect of the fear of losing what happens in the West. The implementation of indentured labor in the Indian subcontinent is a direct consequence of the fear of losing the economic power that they feel they might lose by what is happening in the West. The second thing is to grant concession to slave masters, to grant concessions to those who own enslaved labor, to keep them inside the empire. And so what we find with legislators is that they have this continuous tiptoeing around the question of enslaved labor. On the one hand, by the 19th century, saying, oh, yes, it's morally, you know, questionable and terrible and everything else, but no, we have to be careful how we word, you know, these acts, and, you know, we have to, you know, we have to be careful. So there's a whole slew of acts, you know, starting in 1788, going forward to 1807, 1833, to the 1870s, and they're all sort of tiptoeing around the matter. And there's all loopholes that those who have enslaved labor can get round. What is significant, however, is that the 1833 Act seems on the face of it to say, look, not only is enslaved labor illegal, not only is the trade illegal, but also you have to stop doing what you're doing. It seems to say that. But it doesn't really mean that. Because if you are a slave owner on a plantation in Jamaica, you're going to keep your labor enslaved, which is precisely what happened. And the result is that even by 1865, you know, 32 years after the 1833 Act, the Africans in Jamaica are complaining about the fact that they are living under the imposition of enslavement. And that's precisely why there's the Moorish Bay Rebellion in 1865.
Right. So as I understand it, that didn't start as a rebellion. It started as a protest led by this guy, Paul Bogle, saying, we are freed men and yet we have no rights. We're living in poverty with no justice and we can't vote because we can't afford to pay the poll tax. Where's the freedom we were promised? And the local governor, John Eyre, comes down very hard on them.
Yeah, people like Paul Bogle start off initially demanding that they have the right that the British Parliament has given them, but that the local legislature is denying to them, right? So there's something interesting happening there. And of course, the Moorish Bay Rebellion is put down in a very bloodthirsty way, a really bloodthirsty way, to say, look, you know, this country, if we can call Jamaica a country, will be run according to the laws of this legislature, no matter what the British Parliament is saying. And what does British Parliament do about it? Well, when Governor Eyre comes to Britain, polite society is divided. People like Charles Dickens, yes, Charles Dickens, is actively saying, well, I think Governor Eyre did a good job in putting down this rebellion. We don't want chaos or mayhem, you know? Whereas someone like Charles Darwin, who we might feel was on the other side, is saying, no, this is terrible. This is morally objectionable. So that gives us an idea of the two Charles's opposing perspective on this matter, to give us an idea that even by 1865, British polite society is still divided on this matter.
And if we're talking about the legacy of slavery, society is still divided. Many people saying, oh, we don't need to be constantly reminded of it. And others saying, well, we do actually. And certain types get furious that the National Trust now puts up small signs in some of their country houses, pointing out where the money came from to pay for these lovely old buildings and fill them with beautiful things, saying, this is spoiling the visitor experience. Can't we just look at the nice paintings?
I think it's difficult, Charlie, because the very nature of how enslavement worked and how economically the inverted commas benefits flowed into almost every aspect of British society, from insurance to shipping, the cotton industry, the iron industry, the steel industry, the gun making industry, the chains that were used to do the enslavement, manufactured in places like Birmingham. You know, the guns that were used to suppress African states were manufactured in Birmingham. You know, the canal building industry. There is such a symbiotic connection to almost every aspect of the first phase of the Industrial Revolution that is connected to. And by default, the second phase of the Industrial Revolution is on the foundation of the first phase. And therefore, so much of the money and the whole economy and the foundation of British imperialism is so entwined in this that it's very difficult to separate the activities. So people say, well, if it can't be separated, then we shouldn't. If this is so fundamentally an aspect of it, let us just put it as a detail of history, you know, because if we start to unpick it, then we unpick the very nature of British society. And that frightens people.
Well, you know, to say that it's wrong to even talk about it is it's insanity. And as I touched on before, the goods that were brought back from the Americas, coffee, tea, tobacco, sugar, very cheaply kept the British workers going in all the new factories that were being built.
So the Industrial Revolution is so inexplicably tied to it. And it's not just that. It is the knock-on well. We take a place like Liverpool. Liverpool is this little small village. When it becomes the largest slave trading city in the world, it goes into this huge metropolitan industrial place. These people who were involved in this activity invest in the infrastructure of Liverpool. And that's happening across the country and across the empire. This money is being invested into the Industrial Revolution. It is driving Britain's industrial growth. It is driving Britain to become, you know, this international powerhouse, you know, the most powerful nation in the world. It's fueling this. And even when Britain sort of divests itself of the, you know, the morally questionable aspects of enslaving people, the wealth that came from it, you know, is so inexplicably tied to Britain's growth. And in a way, the 1833 Act and the fact that people often don't remember that even when enslavement officially is sort of supposed to have sort of come to an end through the 1833 Act, millions and tens of millions of pounds were paid out to those people who owned those enslaved people. Unfortunately, like, you know, like the Cameron family or Benedict Cumberbatch's family or Sebastian Coe's family, you know, huge, William Gladstone's family, huge amounts of money was paid from the British taxpayers' purse to compensate people that didn't really need compensating, to be honest. So it's not as if we could get to a moral position where we said, oh yes, Britain was the largest slave trading nation in the world, but Britain brought slavery to an end, which is often the beginning and the end of the story. It's not really as simple as that. Yeah. Really isn't.
Well, history never is. You know, in my series, I've taken a very narrow focus of the royal family through them trying to kind of look at what else was going on. And we were talking before we came on about the idea of history is not a set,
absolutely,
fixed thing. And how we look at what happened in the past can,
certainly,
change all the time, and the evidence,
certainly,
changes all the time. And that we have to be open to that, and we have to get involved,
certainly,
in that. And that's, you know, it's not just, it's a bunch of stuff that was,
absolutely,
written down in books in the Victorian era, and
absolutely,
why should we change it? Yeah, we're always trying to find out more about what happened in the past and why, which is precisely what I'm trying to do in this podcast. And I certainly don't know everything, which is why I'm totally indebted to proper historians like you to help me understand it all. Although, of course, historians don't always agree with each other.
So, I mean, but that's a feature of historical examination, full stop. If you think you've got the answer, then you haven't. There isn't a moment where you know what the answer is, or you know, and that's the summation of the narrative. The narrative doesn't end, it goes on. And as we investigate, we develop wider narratives, we expand our understanding. There's not a point where we feel we know everything that we can about this subject. And any historian that does, any historian that says, okay, this is the answer and there is no other answer, then there's a severe question mark around that, because history, contrary to some people's opinion, isn't really an exercise in polemical narratives. It is an exercise in continuous discourses of investigation around evidence and what have you. That's what history is. It's not a full stop. It's a continuing process of investigation that goes on and on. And we are revising our narratives all the time. Although some people don't like the idea.
Yes, and it often seems to be non-historians who don't like it. Stop rewriting history. But we will always be, well, not rewriting history, but rewriting the history books.
Alardo Equiano, an African living in Britain, is heavily critical of Granville Sharp and Thomas Clarkson. He says that they are involved in abolition for their own economic benefits and because they get involved in activities in Sierra Leone. He says that what they're doing in Sierra Leone is nothing but the reintroduction of indentured labor, and that's one step away from enslavement, is what Alardo Equiano says, criticizing these very people who we call abolitionists now. So this history is a very complicated history. Certainly it is. But what we do know is that this whole history had a devastating effect on Africa. Right? We know that. And we know that it had a devastating effect, yes, on the Africans in the diaspora, which is quite a well-chronicled history, relatively well-chronicled history. What's not often spoken about is the devastating effect that it had on the continent of Africa, how it resulted in the destabilization of the entire continent. To such an extent that by the end of the 19th century, there wasn't a single African state that was being governed by Africans, with the exception of Ethiopia. So this had a destabilizing effect on one-fifth of the world population. And that destabilization means that the continent of Africa still has not caught up. And part of that is because of these legacy.
There is so much to talk about, Onyeka. We have barely scratched the surface. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for that. I mean, you know, there's a whole series to be got out of this. And I'm sure there's probably our series out there that, on that front, do you know of other sort of podcasts or series that sort of cover this that we could recommend to listeners?
What I would recommend to listeners, if they are inclined, and I hope that some are, is to do their own research, to look up some of the people that we mentioned in this podcast, to read their books, in particular to read the works of some of these Africans living in Britain who have been enslaved, who were working in British society to try and end it. You know, people like Otterbrook Ogano and Alade Equiano, Mary Prince, and these types of people, and to look at their works and their writings, and to investigate, you know, what was the real effect of the 1833 Act, you know, who was financially compensated, they can even look up, because there are now quite extensive lists that describe how much money people receive and how many enslaved people they had. And it reads a good reading in 1833. What I would ask people to do is to do the work, to begin to do that research, and not expect simple answers to complicated questions.
No. No, and, you know, it's something that we're going to be arguing about, and it's going to be having an ongoing effect for a very, very
absolutely.
Long time, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that the exploration of history is the fascinating part of history. And I think that, yes, our emotional memory of history is often affected by the evidence. So there is often a contrast between our emotional memory of how we would want the past to be, and then what the evidence actually suggests about the past. And there is the distinction between the two. And I think we have to be mature and go where the evidence leads.
Yes, and not let our history be owned by people like Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson, which is partly what, you know, why I wanted to do the series. I was saying, look, most people in this country don't know about the history of the monarchy. And, you know, they might have this idea, it's this glorious pageant. It's not.
Yeah.
It's a mess, which is what I share. And well, thank you so much for giving us a wider view of this whole aspect of it, which is this, I say a parallel history. It's not a parallel history. Yeah, it's the same
history. Absolutely. It's the same. And it's a history that is all of our history. Although it may, of course, be more emotionally applicable to some people, it is a history that is a history for everybody. And everybody, I think, will greatly benefit from understanding more about it.
Absolutely. And thank you for helping me understand more about it today. So to wrap up, Onyeka, who, in your opinion, was the greatest abolitionist?
Well, ironically, it's William the Conqueror. Yeah, we know that he wiped out almost a third of the English population, you know, howling or the North. We know that. But he was a person that wanted to introduce a feudal system where people would be tied to the land. What slavery does is tie people to people through personal obligation. And it has the capacity to make individuals extraordinarily wealthy. This is why the feudal system doesn't really tolerate enslavement. The slave labor who existed under the Anglo-Saxon system were quickly incorporated within serfdom. And most slaves became serfs between 1066 and 1086. So William the Conqueror is the one that actually introduced into the legislature that this country would be a slave trading nation, or a nation that permitted enslavement, but not necessarily for moral reasons. These are for economic and political reasons, and in fact, to gain more control through feudalism.
Well, there we are. It shows you what a complicated subject this is. So huge thanks to my guest Onyeka Nubia. And if you want to go deeper into the story of African people in Britain, get hold of his book, Blackamoors, Africans in Tudor England. And if you've enjoyed this episode, make sure to listen to the next regular episode of Willy Willy Harry Stee. And if you have any thoughts on this episode, or indeed any of the episodes in the series, or the series in general, please get in touch with me via the series email, which is charlie@willywilly.co.uk. Willy spelt the same as in the podcast description, W-I-L-L-Y. And I look forward to hearing from you. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Steve was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Steve, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.